The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall read you from Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with the Reader's Digest. And of national interest article in this month's Reader's Digest is, what happens to all the stuff we return? Think your rejects go back on the shelves? Think again. The 20-something daughter of a friend recently ordered half a dozen new dresses. She'd been invited to the wedding of a college classmate and knew in advance that she was going to send back all but one of the like the best. Swimsuits and dresses for weddings, you never buy just one, says Joni Demmer, co-founder of Crazy Coupon Lady. For some online apparel retailers, returns now average 40% of sales. Steady growth in internet shopping has been accompanied by a steady growth in returns. A forest worth of artificial Christmas trees goes back every January. Bags of green plastic Easter grass goes back every spring. Returns of large screen TVs surge immediately following the Super Bowl. People who buy portable generators during weather emergencies use them until the emergencies have ended, and then those go back too. People who have been invited to fancy parties sometimes buy expensive outfits or accessories, then return them the next day, caviar stains and all, a practice known as wardrobing. Brick-and-mortar stores also allow shoppers to return unwanted purchases. Petco takes back dead fish, Donner said. Home Depot and Lowe's let you return dead plants for a year. You just have to be shameless enough to stand in line with the things you killed. Last year, I attended a three-day conference in Las Vegas conducted by the Reverse Logistics Association, a trade group whose members deal with product returns, unsold inventories, and other capitalistic jetsam. The field is large and growing. Dale Rogers, a business professor at Arizona State, gave a presentation with his son Zachary Rogers, a business professor at Colorado State, during which they said that winter holiday returns in the United States are now worth more than $300 billion a year. So 1.5% of the U.S. GDP, which would be bigger than the GDP of many countries around the world, is just stuff that people got for Christmas and said, nah, do they have blue? Zachary said. The annual retail value of returned goods in the U.S. is said to be approaching $1 trillion. Most online shoppers assume that items they return go back into regular inventory to be sold again at full price. But that rarely happens. At the conference, I joined the roundtable led by Nikos Papagiannou, who manages returns of Amazon's house brand electronic devices, including Kindles, Echoes, and Blink home security systems. I asked what proportion of returned products are resold as new. It's minimal, he said. If the seal has been broken, if the wrap is not intact, then it's going back to the shelf. Then it's not going back to the shelf. How we got here? For a long time, a shocking percentage of online returns were simply junked. The industry term is DIF, for destroy and field. This happens with cheap clothes, defective gadgets, and luxury items. But in most product categories, it's less common than it used to be. People often assume that easy refunds and exchanges began with the online shoe store Zappos, which was founded in 1999. Tony Hsieh, the company's legendary late CEO, offered free returns for up to a year after purchase and encouraged people to order items in multiple styles and sizes. That policy, backed by intensely personal customer service, was so popular that the company's revenues grew more than sixfold in 4 years. In fact, America's true refund pioneer was born a century before C on a farm in Oklahoma. In 1902, he moved to Kemmerer, Wyoming, in order to become a one-third owner of a general store called Golden Rule. Within a few years, he had bought out his partners and opened more stores. In 1913, he consolidated his holdings under his own name, J.C. Penney. The initials stand for James Cash. One of his innovations was allowing customers to return anything, no questions asked. That approach made a permanent impression on Sam Walton, who went to work at a penny store in Des Moines in 1940. 22 years later, Walton founded his own chain, Walmart, and adopted a similarly generous return policy, which is still in effect. Homer Simpson, the customer's always right, that's what everybody likes about us. A century ago, the average return rate at Penny's was probably something like 2%. Before Internet shopping truly took hold and retail returns has risen to more like 8 or 10%, returns to online retailers now average close to 20%, and returns of apparel are often double that. Among the many reasons, products often look like nothing like their online images, such as a crochet bikini top that was barely big enough for the purchaser's cat, and colors and fabrics appear different on different screens. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated growth in online shopping, and therefore in returns, by several years. Quarantine lawyers bought fewer neckties but more sweatpants and bedroom slippers. People who were suddenly forced to work from home ordered desk chairs and computers. Pre-pandemic, a common shopping strategy was to study possible purchases in a regular store and save a few dollars by order from Amazon. When in-person shopping became difficult, the best way to compare products was to order multiples and send back the rejects. Retailers try to keep up. Returns are expensive for sellers, since shipping alone often costs more than the items can be resold for. Many retailers have responded by shrinking their refund windows or by imposing fees for postage or so-called restocking. Some sellers offer store credit only. Amazon now adds a frequently returned item label to some listings and encourages potential purchasers to double-check descriptions and customer reviews before ordering. The online business model of the eyeglasses seller Warby Parker is based on easy returns. Customers can order as many as 5 frames at no risk to try on at home. The company still offers that option, but has reduced its return cost by employing an increasingly sophisticated online tool that allows customers to try on glasses virtually. It also has physical stores which have mirrors. Despite the cost, retailers worry that discouraging returns discourage buyers in the first place. Easy returns are like free shipping. They can be dealer maker or a deal breaker when a consumer is deciding where to shop, even though in both cases the cost is ultimately borne by the consumer. Most online mattress sellers offer free returns, in some cases for up to a year. Used mattresses can't be resold, so the loss, usually some 8 to 9% of sales, is folded into prices. You've got to tread carefully if you try to ratchet back ease of returns so that you don't drive your customers to your competitor, says Chuck Johnson, who served as Walmart's Senior Director of Returns between 2005 and 2012, and is now the Chief Strategy Officer at GoTRG, a return management company. As a consequence, even as sellers are subtly and not so subtly discouraging returns, they're also exploring ways to make them easier. Some Target stores now have drive-up refund windows. Many online returns no longer have to be repackaged. Just get a QR code on the seller's site and take the item to a location that consolidates shipments. Amazon offers Prime customers a 7-day try-before-you-buy option on selected apparel and accessories. You pay only for what you keep. Pollen returns use underemployed rideshare and delivery drivers to pick up unwanted items, free at buyers' homes, therefore sparing them the nuisance of schlepping things on their own. Some retailers simply refund certain purchases, no need to send anything back. My wife ordered a funny poster for a high school reunion, then decided it wasn't funny enough. When she tried to return it, Amazon told her to keep it and refunded her $32.72. Perhaps surprisingly, companies that sell sofa beds, dining tables, and other bulky, heavy items often do the same, because return freight is so expensive. A new industry blooms. If you leave money lying around, someone will pick it up. Liquidity Services operates 8 regional warehouse-sized facilities in North America. The one in Pittston, Pennsylvania, is the outer edge of a business park that also includes a distribution or return facilities owned by Amazon, Home Depot, Lennox, Neiman Marcus, PepsiCo, and a number of smaller companies. The rise of online shopping has been very good for people who build immense, low, flat-roof metal structures. Similar complexes now exist all over the United States, in locations that have easy access to highways and airports. More are always under construction. You can register as a buyer on Liquidity Services' website, as I did recently, and place bids on any one of 100 auctions. I didn't do that, but I did spend a pleasant morning studying items that other people were bidding on, among them a 2-pallet lot containing 654 pounds of sports-related Amazon returns. The lot included 7 pellet guns, 6 clear plastic umbrellas, 8 yoga mats, a minnow trap, wonder what that is, an indoor exercise trampoline, a pair of hiking poles, 2 hoverboards, a quiver's worth of crossbow bolts, 114 items in all. Liquidity Services estimated their combined original value as $6,576. The lot ended up tracking 50 bids. The winner paid $925, shipping not included. None of the bidders were willing to offer more than 15 cents on the dollar, and even at that price they were taking a chance, since there was no guarantee that any particular item would still function. Returned items are often damaged, dented, scratched, or inoperable, and even ones that don't look too bad can be missing parts or accessories. Liquidators must quickly sort and resell goods, usually in bulk. Some companies do more. One of those is American Remanufacturing Company, or ARC, based in Georgia, which contracts with brand owners to receive their returns and, when possible, to repair or refurbish them so they can be sold by others. ARC is also one of Amazon's external repair vendors. For every item, ARC knows the potential resale price, what percentage of that price the brand owner is willing to spend on refurbishment, and the cost of each potential intervention. Some problems are too expensive to address, pressure washers with broken pumps or stripped of usable elements and thrown into a steel hopper, to be sent later to a local recycling company. This spring I met with Paul Adamson, the company's chief revenue officer, at ARC's facility in Union Point, Georgia. The building is on a short and potholed road with an aspirational name, Industrial Boulevard. We walked through the receiving area, a large open space that was filled with recent arrivals, tilting piles of household appliances, stacks of yellow bins containing miscellaneous Amazon returns. We stopped in front of a pallet on which half a dozen Husqvarna pressure washers, made under license by Briggs & Stratton, had been stacked and bound with plastic wrap. Workers sorted units by model and year of manufacture. They checked electrical components and replaced damaged parts with parts they salvaged from returns they couldn't repair. At the end of the line, a worker replaced each Husqvarna label with one from Murray, a brand that Briggs & Stratton owns. Each unit also received a new serial number and a new box, which clearly identified it as a refurb. These will all end up at the discount chain Ollie's, where they'll sell it for maybe half of what a new one costs, said Adamson. The pandemic was good for the refurb market, which makes sense because many products categories, supply chain problems, made new items scarce. A large number of returns ARC receives, Adamson said, are remorse returns. You order something late on the night after drinking too much wine, or you and your spouse accidentally order the same thing. I saw bins of window curtains in another part of the building. All were from Amazon, many in packages that hadn't even been opened. Pressure washers, by contrast, are often returned because people who bought them don't read instructions. You're always supposed to hook a pressure washer up to water before you turn it on. But a lot of people don't do that, and they burn up the motor, Adamson says. I asked whether Briggs & Stratton could prevent that problem by adding a cutoff switch to the water tank. He said that such a fix was unlikely to be cost-effective, and a more practical solution would be to add an extra warning tag or sticker. A vanishing skill set. I visited another ARC facility and was shown around by David Hogan, the company's CEO. At a workbench, two technicians were repairing upright vacuum cleaners, which were deluxe enough that ARC could cost-effectively give them lots of individual attention. The two technicians that Hogan and I watched are members of a rapidly vanishing species, people who know how to repair stuff. It used to be that when something went wrong with our dishwasher, washing machine, or oven, my wife or I would call a guy who owned a local appliance repair company. Once he got our dishwasher working again by taking apart the grinder and removing what we guessed were broken pieces of ceramic, they were actually coyote teeth, long story. The last time I called him, 7 or 8 years ago, he said he'd had to get a job as a greeter at Home Depot, because nowadays, when appliances malfunction, most people simply buy new ones. That change is partly the result of consumer ignorance and laziness, but manufacturers are at fault, too. Almost all modern appliances contain electronics, which not only have a limited lifespan, but are also usually impossible to repair and expensive to replace. Our former repairman once told my wife and me that we should always buy the dumbest appliance we could find. That was excellent advice, but it's close to useless now, since even blenders and coffee maker contains microchips. Another challenge on that few products today are manufactured with repair in mind. You see it when you get inside the product as we do, Hogan said. A lot of it is material selection or the way the assembly was executed. Two significant impediments to repair: components that are glued together rather than screwed, and pieces that were snapped together with plastic fasteners that break off when the pieces are pulled apart. Hogan recently took part in a panel discussion at Ray C. Anderson Center for Sustainable Business at Georgia Tech, his alma mater. He asked the people in the room to imagine a world in which products were so well made and so easy to repair that a company like ARC wouldn't need to exist. I said, "Let me just theoretically offer you a deal," he told me. "I'll sell you a computer for the same price as one you have now, a nice, expensive computer. But it will be twice as durable, and it will weigh half as much, and its battery will last twice as long, and it will have twice the processing power and twice the memory. The only condition," he said, "it would be that returns would not be allowed for any reason." This was Georgia Tech Sustainability Center. So these were super smart engineering hippies, he said. There were probably 40 or 50 people, all MBAs. Hogan assumed that they would all jump at the deal, but no hands went up, not even one. "I was blown away," he said. "It's just astounding to me how embedded returns are in our behavior." When I finished my talk, I said, "Thank you all. I definitely picked the right industry." Online dating profiles decoded. What's in his profile? A picture of himself with a tiger. What he wants, you think, he's brave. What he really means, he's been to the zoo. What's in his profile? "I love long walks." What he wants you to think is he's romantic. What it really means, he doesn't own a car. What's in his profile? "Let's go for coffee." What he wants you to think is he wants to get to know you. What it really means, he only has $3 in his wallet. How about a drama in real life? Disaster on the river. Two canoeists struggle to keep themselves and their friendship afloat. I was sitting at my desk when my phone buzzed. It was a text from Angus Menzies, my best friend since childhood. Our plan to go canoeing near our hometown in Ottawa, Canada, was a go. Ottawa, Ontario was a go. My apologies. "Grab a brand new canoe for us to use," he wrote. "What's your ETA?" I replied that I'd leave work early to catch a bus to Ottawa that afternoon in July 2017. As I arranged with my wife, Cornelia Mars, I would only be gone for 24 hours, a mini-vacation that seemed impossibly exciting after many months spent close to home helping care for our 2-year-old daughter. I felt invigorated on the Greyhound bus a couple of hours later as it rumbled steadily toward onward, the forest a blur outside the window. It had been a year since I'd seen Angus, but as kids, then teenagers, and into our 20s, we were inseparable, more like brothers than friends. Although we'd seen each other infrequently in recent years, both of us busy with our families and living in different cities, he never felt out of reach. Angus was waiting in the parking lot in the run-down Ottawa bus station when I stepped off the bus into the hot sun. We hugged and climbed into his blue pickup, punk rock blasting. He drove and we shot the breeze. I felt the mix of comfort and apprehension that develops when you've known someone for 30-plus years. Comfort in knowing the person in some ways better than you know yourself. Apprehensive if you wonder if you still have anything in common. But within minutes, we had settled into an easy back and forth. If Angus was the leader of our group of friends as we navigated our teens, the rest of us paying close attention as he defeated bullies and attracted the prettiest girls, inspiring the rest of us to be our greatest versions of ourselves, then maybe I acted as sort of the consigliere, a trusted advisor, because I surely wasn't physical brave or comfortable with girls or tough. I can be cautious to the point of timidity, while Angus is quick to take on unknown challenges, often successfully, but sometimes with serious consequences. As best friends, Angus and I were complementary, and my cautiousness contrasting with his confidence. The next morning, Angus's kids quietly ate breakfast as we grown-ups talked about the day to come. "Didn't you get caught in a storm last year?" his wife, Robin McKellen, asked. I remember that canoe trip well. We'd hit the river with a plan to clamp for the night, but without actually knowing where that would be. This was typical. Whenever we'd hang out, we would drum up some sort of adventure, maybe to prove that we hadn't become old geezers incapable of spontaneity or handling adversity. We ended up landing on a sandy beach on a small island where we pitched a tent and cooked sausages over a fire. That night it rained ferociously. Thunder exploded overhead, and we worried a tree would fall on our tent. The next morning, I stood on the shore with my hood pulled up against the wind, studying the choppy, threatening river. I felt uneasy about the idea of heading out, but we had no choice. Soon we were paddling hard, cresting 2-foot-high swells with determination, and we made it across without capsizing. Now Angus and I stood in his garage and packed up our sparse gear, paddles, two life jackets, and a small cooler with trail mix, apples, and beer. We'll only be gone for a few hours, Angus told Robin. We loaded our 16-foot canoe into the bed of a truck, its aluminum body gleaming under the late morning sun. And when we pulled in at the launch spot at Shirley's Bay on the Ottawa River, the beach was deserted with its wide belly and reinforced bow and stern. The canoe was heavy, and we struggled to carry it to where the river lapped at the sand. Then we stepped in and pushed off into the dark blue water. Angus and I paddled at a steady pace on the swollen body of the massive river. 2 months before, it had reached a record high of around 200 feet, the highest in nearly 40 years. A few hundred yards out in a gentle breeze, we stopped paddling. Angus grabbed a Pabst Blue Ribbon and I reached munched on trail mix. A mile or so ahead of the shore curved inward, narrowing the river. There, just offshore, was a small island. Steering us toward the channel between the island and the river's edge, Angus said from the back seat, "That's where we're going, the Duchene Rabbits." 20 minutes later, the sun was beating down, the breeze gone. I spotted a sandy beach and suggested we land there to eat and take a short hike to look at the rapids. "Nah," said Angus, "let's just run them and then stop for lunch." We kept paddling. Soon I saw a thin white line in the water between the shore and the island. Rapids. I said that if we could see the chop from this far away, the rapids must be treacherous, and we should check them before venturing. Angus pushed to keep going, and again I agreed. Before long, we heard the deep rumble. It was the sound of the rapids. I prickled with fear, but we pressed on. A few minutes later, we crossed a line of small red buoys that neither of us recognized as our last warning. As we approached the channel, the rumble grew to a roar. We couldn't see where the rapids were leading, since the river curved ahead, but the careful Kirby told me they would be more than we bargained for. "Go for the island," I shouted. "Too late," said Angus, as we swept past its rocky tip. Suddenly we were accelerating, the water turning from deep blue to frothy brown. I had been on my knees in the hall and now quickly sat up on the bench. We paddled over a 3-foot swell and came down with a smack as a bigger wave sped toward us. We hit it high and at an angle. As the canoe tipped over, I leaped clear, hitting the cold, rushing water. I quickly serviced, my glasses and shoes gone, trying to get my bearings. I was moving fast down the rapids. The canoe, upside down, slid across the rushing current to my right. Angus took a couple strokes toward it, couldn't reach it, and ended up behind me. I saw the surge of water ahead. Tika took a deep breath and smashed through. It was like getting bowled over by a fire hose. The current was impossible to resist. Feeling strangely calm, I relaxed my arms and pulled up my knees and let the river carry me. For a moment, the sensation was otherworldly, like riding the back of some prehistoric creature. Another whitecap rushed at me, and I plowed through it. After tumbling under water, I came up and shook the water from my eyes and saw the dam, a 20-foot-high wall of concrete and stone a few hundred yards ahead. I smashed through another rapid as Angus shouted something unintelligible behind me. To the left, I could see the battered gray wall of the dam extending about 100 feet out before it crumbled, like a shattered staircase into the rapids. The river was charging at this barricade, as if it was insulted, blasting the wall and crashing back over itself in white roll, pierced by dozens of boulders. To my right, the wall of the dam met a second perpendicular wall, forming a sickening 90-degree death trap, where water swirled and fumed in a dark vortex. I was sucked under and felt a moment of genuine serenity in the quiet and dark, away from the nightmare waiting on the surface. Briefly, I thought, where's Angus? I burst to the surface, the roar of the rapids all around me. On my right, the canoe had somehow kept pace beside me, bumping and scraping its way down rocks towards the dam. I still felt calm and clear-headed, even as I assessed my chances of death or serious injury as nearly inevitable. I knew I couldn't fight the river. I couldn't swim to shore or navigate the minefield of sharp stone ahead, or dodge the wall that my body would likely be pulped against. As I flew down the rapids, I suddenly saw something more unbelievable than the dam itself. A hole, a portal through which the century-old ruin, through which I could see light, sky, and calm water on the other side. That's where I'm going, I thought. My vision was a clear line to the jagged, window-sized hole in the river had punched through the concrete. I felt sure that if I didn't struggle, the river would carry me through it. Then, as if out of another dimension, I heard Angus's voice, calm and confident, right behind me. "Hold on to the canoe," he said. I'd been trying to stay away from the canoe, fearing that the metal hull would catch a rock and bash me in the head. Now, trusting Angus, I reached across the churning water, grabbed the canoe, and managed to drape my arms over it. We careened down the rapids, the canoe and I, Angus somewhere behind, the boom of water deafening. I put my cheek to the canoe's upturned belly and closed my eyes. I knew an impact was coming, but I didn't know when. Then we hit the dam. The force of the canoe slamming into the wall made me see stars. Still hanging onto that canoe, I waited with my eyes jammed shut for the sound of my bones breaking. But felt nothing. I opened my eyes. The river had thrown the canoe directly above the hole in the dam I'd been aiming for, half crushing at midpoint. The current held the canoe against the wall as I dangled a couple feet above the hole where the river was blasting through. I took a huge breath, let go of the canoe, and dropped into the torrent immediately. I was sucked down into the cold undertow. I brought my hands to my head to protect myself. I was under for a few long seconds, balled up like a cannonball as the river flushed me through the hole. And suddenly, I was bobbing in the middle of the river, the dam now behind me. I looked behind me and around, and there, 20 yards away, was Angus. "Yeah, you okay?" he asked. "Yeah, nothing broken. You?" "My feet are wrecked," he said. "I got dragged across the bottom. I thought I was going to drown." "Where were you?" Angus explained how he had grabbed a strap trailing from my life jacket and held it as we carried downstream. When the canoe slammed into the dam, the force of the current had sucked him out through the same hole I dropped into moments later. Now as we treaded water, both of us without our glasses, the current moved us steadily along. We saw a strange shape some distance away and eventually recognized it as the canoe, half submerged and twisted into scrap metal. And there's a picture of it here, and it does look like somebody grabbed each end of it and twisted it. I suggested we swim for the foreshore since we had life jackets. "Too far," Angus said. "Let's go for the other shore." But remnants of the rapid were there between us and land, so we agreed to flag down a boat. By pure luck, a few minutes later, a small pleasure craft came into view. We hollered and whistled, and the boat, piloted by a father and his two preteen sons, came over and picked us up. The boys gaped as we sat on the deck, soaked and shivering. As we chugged ashore, we saw a fleet of fire rescue trucks surrounded by a crowd of about 30 people. They watched as the firefighters wrapped an emergency blanket around Angus and me. They checked us over, examining Angus's feet, which were cut and scraped but not broken. One older fireman said it was a miracle we were alive. "You guys should play the lottery today," soberly. "We wish people fish people out of there all the time." Angus and I learned that the area we had gone through was nicknamed the Coffin. Between 2007 and 2017, at least 6 people died or went missing in the rapids around the dam. A dozen more have been rescued. The firefighters dragged the canoe in. It looked as if it had been hit by an artillery shell. A firefighter phoned Robin and asked her to come pick us up. When she arrived, Angus teared up, and they held each other for a long time. We loaded the canoe into the truck, and Robin drove us back to their place. All I wanted to do was get home. We had a hasty goodbye. Angus passed me a wad of cash to pay for my lost glasses, shoes, and phone. And suddenly I was sitting on a bench in the bus station, still soaking wet and in an old pair of brown Converse sneakers that Angus had given me in a state of shock. I started to cry, then sobbed, alone on the beach, on the bench. For a week afterward, I was a wreck. At work, I'd have to excuse myself from meetings to go outside and weep, shuddering with a memory of the incident. At a cafe, I saw a dessert with blueberries on it, my daughter's favorite, and I started crying, thinking about how close I'd come to never seeing her again. A couple of years later, my wife gave birth to our second child, a son. As I play with him, watching him marvel over leaves and explore the world, I wonder if he will be as lucky as I have been to have a lifelong friendship, where simply being yourself with the other person helps you discover who you are and who you could be. Friendships between men are peculiar and mysterious things. In my experience, their workings are unaffected by missed birthdays or months, and even years of silence. They thrive on laughter and shared undertakings. Angus and I still hang out a couple times a year, and somehow, even after everything we went through, or maybe because of everything we went through, it still feels just like old times. For 31 days running, March is exhausting because it's also a verb. Now for something a little lighter than floating down a rapids and without a canoe. It was a dark and stormy night. The annual Bull Litton Fiction Contest celebrates purposely awful writing. Here's the best of the worst. The man squinted his eyes as the blistering cold winds battered his rugged face, his eyes darting about desperately, hoping, daring to dream that amidst the frozen wasteland he would find the last Klondike bar they had hidden in his freezer. Having attended Oktoberfest, taken in the beautiful foliage of New England, gone apple picking, roamed through a corn maze, and visited a pumpkin patch, one thing was certain. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Officer Meyer Briggs burst into the bedroom and saw Professor Worsatch standing over the body of his mother, bloody knife in hand. "I swear it's not what it looks like," Worsatch explained. "Oh, that's terrible. She was just like Greta, who's poisoned her family, burned down my house, bombed 6 countries, and used a gun on anyone who she wanted short." Those are terrible. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have a bit of a conundrum. Consumer Reports, unfortunately, in their April issue, is all about cars. So what's going to happen over the next couple weeks, we're probably going to spend more time on cars than I would normally do. I know that many of you don't drive or can't drive, but you do ride, and I know you have drivers with you. And people who listen to this program often have people who listen with them. So I'm going to go ahead and read what I have, and I apologize again for Consumer Reports being auto-fixated. But that's just the way things are. The most and least satisfied models in their class. These charts are held likely to satisfy you most. Even cars that don't rank high in overall satisfaction can excel in ways that matter to you, such as how comfortable they are or whether the infotainment system is easy to master. Similarly, some models with high satisfaction scores may still have specific issues that will make you want to take a pass. We ask owners to rate their satisfaction when considering their vehicle's seat and cabin comfort, driving, cabin storage, and cabin experience and usability, and ownership cost. Use their feedback and corresponding scores to identify any models that fit your needs. In comfort, while most satisfying models commended their vehicle's comfort, Murano offers were effusive, praising its comfortable seats and quiet cabin. Miata owners repeatedly noted how hard it was to get in and out of, while Wrangler owners bemoaned a lack of ride comfort. As a big person, I know how hard it is to get in and out of a Miata. Most satisfying was the in sports and sporty cars was the Audi A5, the midsize two-row SUVs, the Nissan Murano, the electric vehicles, the Kia Niro EV, and compact doors, the Toyota Prius. The least satisfying were the Mazda MX-5, Miata, the Jeep Wrangler, the Nissan Leaf, and the Toyota Corolla hatchback, and 3 of those are small cars. Driving. Suburban and Yukon XL owners like the handling of their big SUVs, while CX-30 owners enjoyed a small SUV's ride and performance and fun-to-drive nature. Taos owners were bothered by how the SUV surged when starting from a stop, while the Compass was faulted for its weak acceleration. The most satisfying to drive were the Toyota Prius and the compact cars. For subcompact SUVs, the Mazda CX-30. For compact SUVs, the Toyota RAV Prime. And midsize three-row SUVs, the Chevrolet Suburban. Least satisfying was the Jeep Compass, the subcompact SUV, the Volkswagen Taos, the Nissan Kicks, and the Volkswagen Atlas. The cabin storage. Tesla owners found plenty of space for both passengers and cargo, while many owners liked how the Countryman had lots of room for hauling stuff. Owners of the Audi Q7 weren't fans of its limited cabin storage, while one Leaf owner said about cabin storage space, "Make it bigger." Most satisfying was the Mini Cooper Countryman, the Tesla Model S, the Honda Passport, and the Lincoln Aviator. Lincoln Aviator is huge. Least satisfying was the Jeep Wrangler, Subaru Solterra, electric cars was the Nissan Leaf and the Audi Q7. Usability. Corsair and GLE owners praised their cars' available features and technology, but the controls in the Volvo, Lexus, Volkswagen, and Subaru were panned, while a Lexus owner asked for it to be more user-friendly, and Volkswagen drivers wished the controls were less complicated. The most satisfying was the Honda Accord Hybrid. Mercedes-Benz GLE, the Genesis GV60, and the Lincoln Corsair were also well-liked. The least satisfying was the Volvo XC60 plug-in hybrid, the Lexus RX, the Volkswagen ID4, and the Subaru Legacy. The most satisfying for ownership cost, the Trailblazer, Highlander, NX, Maverick owners all praised their vehicle's fuel economy. One Maverick owner said being able to get 40 miles per gallon makes it perfect for my job, but owners of the Q3 complained of reliability headaches and maintenance costs. The most satisfying were the Chevrolet Trailblazer, Toyota Highlander Hybrid, the Lexus NX Plug-in Hybrid, and the Ford Maverick Hybrid. The least satisfying the Honda HR-V, the Chevrolet Suburban GMC Yukon XL, the Audi Q3, or the Chevrolet Colorado GMC Canyon. Cars that are really fun to drive. CR's auto test team loves cars, but the dozens they drive each year, the most memorable are the ones that are a treat to drive. An agile car with a quick acceleration and a satisfying sound can be a pleasure, says Gabe Schneier, associate director of CR's Auto Test Center. When it's also reliable, fuel-efficient, and within your budget, it's even more enjoyable. And don't make the mistake of thinking that only sporty performance cars can deliver excitement on the road. CR's testers have found that numerous sedans, luxury cars, and even small SUVs that can be entertaining. The models below are among those that rank higher in our fun department, yet are also really reliable, safe, and fuel-efficient. We provide a mix of new and used in several categories and a wide range of prices. For the sports car, it's the 2023 Mazda MX-5 Miata, which sells for anywhere from $28,000 to $38,000. Fun factor, driving a small, capable, and attractive two-seater with the top down and the wind in your hair is a quintessence of automotive fun. And the Miata delivers that in its purest form. Pros, on top of its nimble handling, a playful exhaust sound, and classic sports car proportions, the Miata tends to have strong resale value in case you ever need to trade in for something more practical. The cons, tight interior might be cramped for larger drivers. The trunk is very small, well under 5 cubic feet, with only enough room for some groceries or luggage for a weekend getaway. In a small car, the 2015 to 2016 Ford C-Max, $8,600 to $12,000. Fun factor, the C-Max Hybrid is more than just a utilitarian economy car. It offers lively handling and an electric motor, and its hybrid powertrain provides a healthy dose of torque for zippy acceleration. Pros, among its agility, the C-Max has a stable ride, a roomy interior, hatchback utility, and more than 24 cubic feet of cargo space. Less than the plug-in hybrid version, which has a larger battery pack. The C-Max got 37 miles per gallon overall in our fuel economy testing, and CR members reported seeing higher figures. The cons, the tester found that certain controls were annoying to operate. Some may find its minivan-esque look a turnoff. It is kind of weird-looking. Small SUV, the 2024 Mazda CX-5, $29,000 to $40,000. Fun factor. The sporty handling, sleek styling, and responsive steering of the CX-5 set it apart from more rational, less exciting choices, such as the Honda CR-5 and the Subaru Forester. Its emerging dynamics and SUV utility prove that it can have your cake and eat it too. Pros, compared with the other SUVs in its price range, the CX-5 has more comfortable ride, one of the quietest, highest quality interiors available, and standard automatic emergency braking. Cons. It has less interior space and worse visibility than its doughty competitors, and its complicated infotainment controls can take a while to get used to. Then we get to the luxury cars. 2016, 2018 to 2022 BMW 3 Series from $11,000 to $47,000. Fun factor, long known as one of the best sports sedans on the market, the 3 Series has the requisite agile handling, responsive brakes and steering, and snappy acceleration. It's also a downright playful. The 2019 redesign brought more active safety features and better fuel economy. The pros. The 3 Series blends great performance and handling with a dapper styling, a luxurious interior, and a relatively easy-to-use infotainment system. The cons. Routine maintenance can be more expensive than for non-luxury models. And if the car is out of warranty, repairs can be very, very pricey, and I will testify to that. And then we have the better deal page. SUVs, the BMW X1 for $40,000 to $50,000, scored a 79 on our scale. The better deal is the Mazda CX-50, $30,000 to $43,000, scored a 77. The lowdown, the redesigned BMW X1 has more power, efficiency, and interior room than previous generations, but it's pricey and costs a lot to gas up as it takes only premium. The Mazda CX-50 has similar handling and a bit more interior space. Even the Welly CX50 Premium Plus we tested, $38,600, significantly undercuts the X1S tested price of $46,500. What's more, both predictor reliability and owner satisfaction scores are higher for the CX50. And having owned two BMW X1, I'll tell you, they are fun to drive. I have not owned a Mazda SUV, so I can't testify to that. Waffle makers. Breville Smart Waffle Pro 4 slice for $250. Scored an 89. The Chefman Anti-Overflow Belgian Waffle Maker for $40. Scored a 76. If you really love waffles, the top-rated 250 Breville may be for you. It aced all our tests, turned out evenly cooked waffles with the exact level of doneness you want. Its exterior stays cool to the touch, and the Breville makes four large squares at once. But it does take a lot of space. For over $200 less, the Chefman also makes superb evenly cooked waffles, albeit in a smaller size. It has a light at the dark settings and shows when a waffle is done. The outside of the Chefman does get hot, but it's compact and stores neatly on its side. Chromebooks. Lenovo IdeaPad Slim Chromebook at $550, scored an 85. The Acer Chromebook Vero 514 at $350, scored an 84. The lowdown. These two Chromebooks are just 1 point apart in our ratings. They both have entry-level Intel processors and the same amount of memory and storage. The Lenovo has a touch screen for more convenient navigation and a slightly longer battery life, but both should last about a day before requiring a recharge. If you don't need a touchscreen, the budget-friendly Acer is a really good bet. And a letter from Maria Tellado, the president and CEO of CR. Why recalls aren't enough. Doors that open when you drive, airbags that don't deploy properly, engines that catch fire. These are just three reasons for car recalls in the past 6 months. While these voluntary recalls by automakers are a good thing, there's more they should be doing to protect drivers, passengers, and pedestrians. Prioritizing safety from the start means improving the protective technology that also becomes standard in every vehicle, like airbags, which we write about later on in this article. But some of the latest safety features aren't available in all new autos, or consumers are required to pay extra to get them. This includes automatic crash notification, which dials 911 for you after a collision, and automatic emergency braking that can detect pedestrians both at night and when you're driving at higher speeds. The bottom line, safety shouldn't be a luxury add-on. Protecting your backseat passengers matters too. Last year, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety released the first formal front crash tests in the U.S. focused on passengers sitting in rear seats, and it revealed the need for better protection there. CR provides rear seat safety ratings from our own testing, and we're pushing manufacturers to implement new standard safety technology that protects those in the back seat. There's also a need for automakers to provide real solutions for problems after a car has been recalled. Last December, our experts tested changes to Tesla's autopilot driver assistance features, which have been updated by the company to address the potential for drivers to misuse that technology. CR testing found that the update didn't go far enough in addressing this important safety concern. This is why CR continues to push for automakers and government leaders to always put consumers first by improving your safety on the roads. How we test cars. You have to cover a lot of ground in an automobile to really know how it performs. That's why our experts log thousands of miles on public roads and highways in every vehicle we test, and pushes you to the limit on our 327-acre auto test center in Connecticut. We purchase every tested vehicle anonymously to prevent an automaker from giving us a special version. We also have a tire testing program for cars, SUVs, and pickup trucks to help you choose the best replacement tires. The team at our auto test center recently added a battery of new tests to more thoroughly access electric vehicles. These include evaluations of their highway driving range, charging speed, and other EV-specific factors. 50 models are bought secretly each year and put through more than 50 test factors, including handling, accelerating, and braking. And then they have a drawing here of their 327-acre test track. Evaluations are done at our auto test center in Colchester, Connecticut. Our 350-foot-long snaking road course lets us assess how well each vehicle negotiates corners. We conduct a panic brake test from 0 to 60 from 60 miles per hour to zero, not only on dry pavement, also on a wet surface. They also have a 1.5-mile loop, allowing us to test how advanced driver assistance deal with curbs, split lanes, exit ramps, etc. And we also have 21 EV charging stations on site, with 10 more coming soon. EV range testing. The Environmental Protection Agency provides only a combined city highway range for EVs. We think highway range is a key concern for consumers, so we base our range score on our own EV Pacific Highway range test. We drive at a constant 70 miles per hour on a 100-mile loop on public roads in dry summer weather, until the EV can no longer move under its own power to gauge how far it can go before it needs recharging on a long trip. Going the distance, the EV range score is initially based on EPA coverage range rating. Once we evaluate a model's highway range, we update the score using our findings. The EPA rating for the Ford 150 Lightning, the EPA has it rated at 320 miles. The CR's highway rating has it only rated at 270 miles. The Mercedes-Benz EQE 350, the EPA has it 260 miles, but the CR highway rating has it rated at 332 miles. Rear seat safety. We evaluate how easily child seats fit into each vehicle, along with how well rear occupant alert and rear barrel minder systems perform if equipped in the vehicle. Rear occupant's alerts can help prevent children and pets from being unintentionally left behind in a hot vehicle, while our rear belt binders prompt rear passengers to buckle up and alert the driver if they unbuckle during the trip. Direct driver monitoring. Active driving assistance systems that are capable of automatic acceleration, braking, and steering, which is the combination of adaptive cruise control and lane centering assistance, can reduce driving stress. But they should be paired with camera-based monitoring to ensure the driver is paying attention to the road and not on their cell phone, like I've seen a couple times. And then we have a listing of their top 10 picks for this year. New car shoppers in 2024 have more than 360 models to choose from. To help you find the right one for you, Consumer Reports selects 10 top picks each year based on road test performance, predicted reliability, owner satisfaction, and safety. All top picks come standard with automatic emergency braking that works at both low speeds with pedestrian detection and at highway speeds. This year's pantheon of automotive excellence in 4 hybrids, 3 plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and 1 electric vehicle, confirming that models with full or partially electrified powertrains can best their gas-only rivals. Subaru and Toyota made a strong showings again this year, with 2 and 4 models respectively. These two brands consistently offer smartly engineered models with simple controls, comfortable cabins, and the infotainment and advanced safety features that matter most. History and extensive survey analysis show that the reliability of most models improves over the time they are in production, with the last year of each generation typically being the most trouble-free, which adds to the appeal of the 2024 Subaru Forester and Toyota Camry. Both will be redesigned for the 2025 models. These Subaru and Toyota models only and the Ford Maverick Hybrid are the only vehicles that were also top picks last year. The Tesla Model Y makes its debut on the model on the list. The Model 3 was on it last year, added for improved reliability, making it a second showing. The BMW X5 takes the top spot for luxury vehicles. Subcontract SUV, the Subaru Crosstrek, $25,000 to $32,000. Redesigned for 2024, the Crosstrek made evolutionary advancements with engine and transmission refinements, a more modern infotainment system, an optional power seat, and an improved EyeSight suite of active safety features that all heightens its appeal. At 29 miles per gallon overall, the Crosstrek boasts the best fuel economy for a non-hybrid SUV with all-wheel drive, but admittedly, the base 2.0-liter engine is a bit weak. The up-level 2.5-liter engine is quicker, quieter, and more satisfying, added to the experience in the Crosstrek's excellent ride quality and good everyday handling. It's easy to enter, and the cabin is roomy with supportive seats and good outward visibility. The versatile vehicle is well suited to urban errands, that is, to weekend adventures. The hybrid PHEV car is the Prius Prime, $28,000 to $40,000. The latest Prius was treated much like a glow-up, bringing much more sporter styling and 75 more horsepower than its predecessor has. The result is a sensible car that is as efficient as it was before, going from 0 to 60 in a significant 2.6 seconds more quickly, even with the addition of all-wheel drive. Plus, it's cooler looking and more engaging to drive after the makeover, and it is cool looking. Though some comfort elements, such as space and ride, aren't equal to the previous incarnations, and it's much more difficult to see out of. The Prius Prime plug-in hybrid provides 39 electric-only miles, ideally for most daily chores. Once the battery is depleted, the Prime returns to 43 miles per gallon overall, having two powertrain choices, which unique and striking car doubles its appeal. The compact SUV, the Subaru Forester, $27,000 to $37,000. In its last year before a redesign, the Forester still stands tall, making its 11th appearance as a top pick. The winning format includes a boxy design that maximizes interior space and grants unrivaled visibility. Access is a cinch thanks to large doors and an elevated ride height. The seats are comfortable, room is generous, and the squared-off cargo space is copious. The Forester is among the best-riding models in its class, and its handling is responsive and secure. This is a well-rounded small SUV that really delivers, making it easy to recommend year after year. For a small car, the Mazda 3, at $24,000 to $37,000. Mazda provides that small, low-priced cars don't need to be boring. In fact, the Mazda 3 sedan and hatchback are highly entertaining to drive, with its nimble handling and smooth powertrains. The base engine is the cost-effective choice, that it packs 191 horsepower, more than most rivals, and there's a feisty 227 turbo for drivers seeking more verve. The overall feel, especially on higher trims, is more premium than the price suggests, making the Mazda 3 seem a half class above its mainstream competitors. It offers all-wheel drive with either engine, and the BSW and RCTW are standard for 2024. We just wish the controls were less distracting. For a midsize car, the Camry Hybrid, at $29,000 to $34,000. The Camry Hybrid delivers amazing fuel economy in a comfortable package that is priced like some smaller cars that are also less efficient. It stands out for its unique and satisfying combination of virtues, as reflected in its sky-high 94-point road test score. But it is stellar reliability and efficiency that are the main draws. The Camry Hybrid returned 47 miles per gallon overall in our fuel economy test, with 53 miles per gallon on our highway test, making it highly cost-effective for commuting and for a 610-mile range per tank road tripping. This fuel-saving feat is performed with a 208-horsepower hybrid powertrain that is smoother, quieter, more responsive, and a hit quicker than the base four-cylinder. Small pickup is the Maverick Hybrid, $24,000 to $35,000. The Maverick's civilized ride, maneuverability, simple step-in access, fuel economy, and low price distinguish it among trucks. The crew cab interior is roomy and practical, with good leg and headroom in front and back. For such a small vehicle, the controls are easy to use and convenient spots for storage are placed throughout. The 191-horsepower hybrid stands out for its terrific fuel efficiency and added refinement. The Maverick is a high-value offering that puts the fun in functional. For an electric vehicle, the Tesla Model Y, from $44,000 to $52,500. The Model Y tops the electric car platform shared with the Model 3. Its SUV-like body provides more passenger and cargo space than the sedan does. It makes going electric easy, thanks to its appealing midsize packaging, long driving range, and robust supercharger capability, allowing rapid recharging across a vast charging network. The Model Y is stunningly quick in a long range and performance trims, going from 0 to 60 miles per hour in under 5 seconds. Plus, it handles like a sports car with responsive steering and manifold body rolls and turns. Features are added and enhanced to the overall upgrades, so this is already a good car, even gets better over time. The plug-in hybrid SUV, the Toyota RAV4 Prime, $44,000 to $48,000. The immensely popular RAV4 is available with a regular four-cylinder engine and an efficient hybrid powertrain. But the RAV4 Prime plug-in hybrid takes efficient to an even greater heights. It boasts 302 horsepower, enabling the small SUV to scoot from 0 to 60 in a scant 6.3 seconds, 2 seconds quicker than the gas-only version. An unusually long 42-mile electric range means owners can minimize their use of the gasoline engine when the battery is depleted. The RA4 Prime still delivers 34 miles per gallon overall, slightly less than the 36 miles per gallon of the hybrid version. Frisky and frugal, the Prime also rides better and is quieter than other versions, making it a more premium experience all around. For the midsize SUV, it's the Highlander Hybrid, $41,000 to $53,000. The Highlander is a comfortable midsize SUV with a compliant ride, accommodating seats, thoughtful cabin conveniences, abundant active safety features, and commendable predicted reliability. But it really excels at fuel efficiency with its 243 HP hybrid powertrain. No other three-row SUVs achieves 30 miles per gallon in our test, yet the Highlander Hybrid knocks it out of the park with 35 miles per gallon and all-wheel drive. On the highway, it gets 41 miles per gallon, with a full tank has 590 miles of range. The hybrid adds about 1,500 to the gas-only version with a quick payoff in fuel savings. And last but not least is the X5 BMW, $65,000 to $90,000. Traveling in the X5 is a luxury experience. Its whisper quiet cabin is lavished in leather and wood, finished with cushion surfaces, and fitted with cuddling front seats. The balanced suspension provides a supple ride and composed handling that holds its own on curvy roads. The Turbo 6 delivers quick acceleration, but the plug-in hybrid version is a real ace. It also uses a turbo inline 6, but is teamed with an integrated electric motor and a large enough battery for robust electric propulsion. Exquisite in its most every detail, the X5 sets a very high standard. And with that, we'll close out with some laughter. A born and bred New Yorker is in the country when he sees a field of animals and says to the farmer, "What's that strange-looking cow? Why doesn't it have horns?" "There are several reasons," the farmer says. "Some cows get their horns late, others have their horns cut off, and still others never grow horns. And this cow?" the city man asks. "Well, the reason this cow doesn't have any horns is because it's a horse." "Back in my day, I went to the store with only $1 and came back with 2 bags of chips, 1 carton of milk, and 3 boxes of chocolate." Now they have cameras. Name for your middle-aged dad band. The Who Left the Lights On. Cialis and Change. The Arrhythmics. Talking Heads with Subtitles. Blood Work, Sweat, and Tears. REO Station Wagon. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and No Longer Young. Boys to Balding Men. Guess who just saved 10% with their ARP discount? And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-513. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so very much for listening.